This Do Lectures episode features British statistician and professor David Spiegelhalter, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2010.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed. I must say, you know, it's a huge honour and pleasure to be here. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't seem to quite fit in with all this sort of wonderful, active, entrepreneurial spirit that I've seen over the last couple of days, which I sadly have not got. Never mind, I might catch some of it. Just to keep you distracted, this was a picture of this little man down here who's subject to risk. And I just want to illustrate what's going on here. The lightning is coming down, and there's 20 different branches, and each time it splits half and half which side it goes. So, and there's 20, so chance of him being hit down there, it's got a turn left 20 times. It's like flipping a coin 20 times in a row and coming up heads every time. That's almost exactly one in a million chance. So that's true. So he hasn't got hit, because he only got hit because I moved him in. And what this is supposed to illustrate is the fact that each single shot of that is completely unpredictable. However, the pattern they make after, 1,000, 1,200 goes is completely predictable. I knew it'd fit exactly that pattern. It's a binomial distribution. The things can be predictable in the large, which aren't in the small. Now, we've been asked to talk about, where we came from, how we got our journey. Well, my journey started off there as doing maths at school. I really liked maths when I looked like that. And then I went to university and I did maths at university, looked like that. Let this be a warning to you all. And then I did a PhD in statistics and I looked like that. It's not funny. It's a tragic. And now I look like this. So this is what happens to you. This is what happens if you do statistics and maths, that you end up looking like this. I'd still look like that if I hadn't done maths. Anyway, but now, having done statistics as my career, medical statistics, I've been really fortunate in the last 3 years to be in a post funded by Winton Capital Management, a hedge fund, which has paid for my post as Professor of Public Understanding of Risk at Cambridge. Which is extraordinary. I can do exactly what I want. So I'm looking for inspiration here. But at the moment, we do all sorts of stuff. I'll show you some of it. We work with organizations that are interested in communicating risk, in understanding risk. We've got a lot of schools activity. We've got a full-time person going to schools to with our risk roadshow. And I do a lot of schools work as well. You're getting the 16-year-old talk. I hope that's okay. No, you're not getting the standard talk. I've been rewriting it. Yeah. But sometimes, like in The Little Man with the Lightning, we can calculate chances. You know, good old stuff, coins, dice, and that sort of thing. And that's why I got you to do birthdays, because I don't know, there's 70 people in this room. So the chance that you've all got different birthdays we can calculate is unbelievably tiny. So I know there's, to the extent that I am really confident, would bet a lot of money that there's at least two people in this room with the same birthday. And I'm now going to ask my assistants whether there are. What have we got? Six pairs?
Yes.
Any triples?
No.
Oh, I was hoping for a triple. Right. So six pairs. There's six, I don't know if they're twins, but there's six pairs of people here with the same birthday. And so that's because there's a standard rule that if there's more than 23 people in a room, there's a more than 50-50 chance that two of them will share the birthday. So the way to remember that is on a football field, two teams and the referee, half of all football matches, there's two people on the field with the same birthday. So it's a good trick to try out. So that's it. And then I got you to choose a number. Now, there is I'm going to teach you in a moment a little rule for playing this trick with an audience of any size. And I was a bit anxious that no one was going to get up on Sunday morning. So I got you to choose a number between 1 and 500. And that's actually the number appropriate if there are only about 40-something people in the room. Did people choose the same number? What did we get?
Five
pairs?
Yeah.
Great. Could read one of them out? Read out an odd one, just a number. So,
and five.
333. I told you to choose a number nobody else would choose. That's a pathetic number.
It's a triple.
Triple. So three chose 333. No, they don't count. They're hopeless. Go on. That's a strange number.
329.
Through two 329s. Yeah, who are the 329s? Come on, we need some originality here.
Sitting
next to each other. Oh, yeah, cool. That's really good. No, I thought at least two people sitting next to each other should be able to cheat. Oh, that's brilliant. They're sitting next to each other. Okay. In fact, with 70 people in the room, I could have got you to choose a number between 1 and 1,000, and there would have been at least 87% chance that two of you would choose the same number. And just that's by chance, let alone people who choose 333 or 666 or something boring like that. There's a neat trick for remembering this. If you've got any number of people in the room, for example, 40 people in the room, halve it, get 20, square that number, and you get 400, and get them to choose a number between 1 and 400, and there's an 87% chance at least two of them will choose the same number, even if they choose at random. So it's half the number of the people in the room squared. The answer is actually 87% because it's 1 minus 1 over e squared for the nerds in the audience. So if I had 400 people, I could then get them to choose a number between 1 and 40,000, between 200 squared. So it's quite interesting. 400 people in the audience, they can choose any number they want between 1 and 40,000. And I am pretty confident that, and here we got 400 numbers between 1 and 40,000, genuinely at random. Can anyone see any pairs there? Anybody spot any? Come on, you're useless. Let's see if there are. Yep, there are. There are two pairs there. And I can try again. Another, well, let's do that. And let's check that. And loads of pairs. Now, 7 out of 8 times, there will be a match. Ah, missed one. Right. But 7 out of 8 times, there's a... Let's check it. Oh, no. Two all. Oh, dear. Oh, this is bad. I'll tell you where you... Oh, OK, you take a risk. I won't carry on. So, you know, these tricks aren't guaranteed to work. But 7 out of 8 times, there'll be a match out of 400 numbers. So it's a neat trick to remember. OK, so that's the sort of stuff we do with schools, get them to do those sorts of analyses based on known chances. But that's actually very rare that that's the case. As Taleb argues in The Black Swan, this use of dice and known odds to talk about events actually is very restricted. So in fact, what we often do is to use past data to assess odds. So I've been playing around with results, formulae to predict results of football matches. They can work quite well. Lots of people do that. Sports betting companies do that all the time. So let's look at an example of that. Now, we've been eating wonderful food here, but come on, let's face it. This is what we'd rather be having, isn't it? You know, what happened to the Spam fritters and the battered haggis? Why can't we have that? So I'm actually quite partial to this sort of food. I have to admit, I took this in one of my favourite chip shops. And So I go along to my doctor and ask him, what's the chance of me getting heart disease in the next 10 years? And it turns out I'm reasonably fit and it's not too bad, but I've got at least a 10% chance of a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years, which is actually below average, so it's not bad. So 1 in 10 chance that I will have a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years. And then he says, whoa, but I could give you statins. And that would reduce your chance by at least by about 30% or so. Okay, so and I tried to do the sum 30%, and that sounds quite big, but the original chance is only 10%. How big is that? What does that mean? Well, what I'm interested in and working with teams and doing is can you communicate those risks to people? Because it turns out that a lot of people have trouble with percentages. A lot of people have trouble with odds. A lot of people have trouble with numbers, to be honest. And so the kind of way in which people are starting to represent these chances is through the use of icons, of multiple icons, of frequencies. This use of bars stacked up using icons is because it goes back to Otto Neurath and Goethe Arndt and these people, the isotype movement, which grew out of the Bauhaus movement. It's, I think, really wonderful stuff. Now, I don't know if the colours come out very well on the projector, but these are green. These are 90 people like me who won't have a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years. Here are 7 people like me who are going to have a heart attack or stroke anyway, whatever they do. But there's 3 of them, the little smiley yellow ones, that if they take statins every year, every day for the next 10 years, will have their heart attack or stroke prevented. That's the 30% of the 10 who would otherwise have a heart attack or stroke. Now, we can do other ways to present this. I quite like bar charts, but quite often on the ways that things are presented to patients, they're arranged as an icon array like that. There's a big argument in psychology about whether you should block up these, which make it easier to count, or scatter them around. The point is, if you scatter them around, it gives a much better impression of the fact that of the unpredictability of what might happen. We've been playing with all sorts of alternatives to this, which I'd just like to illustrate with you. One of them is to think of the fact that rather than thinking of 100 people like me, to use the image of 100 possible futures for me. And this is what I'm going to get into when we're thinking about risk in deeper uncertainty. We have to envisage all the possibilities of what might happen and what they might be like. So, for example, a good way to illustrate that with images then is actually to put up 100 people like me. In fact, 100 me's. Here's 100 me's, my futures. And the smiley ones, these are the ones I've been saved from having a heart attack or stroke by taking my pills every day. should I do it? But when you arrange it like that, of course, you realise, goodness me, there's only a 1 in 30 chance I'm going to benefit from these damn tablets. You know, it's the only chance of me benefiting from these tablets is if it's like if you throw a dart at that and it hits the yellow one. So actually, this is not a great, this might not be a great benefit. We'll come on to possible other disadvantages in a minute. So we've been playing with other ways to illustrate some of these things, which I'd just like to show as well. If you look at women's deaths. Now, this is, people want to communicate, for example, the risks of smoking. So let's look at a woman who's 55 has never smoked compared with a woman of 55 who has smoked, who's a smoker. And these are all the chances of her dying of various causes over the next 10 years. And this is, of course, the chance of surviving. Let's get rid of the survivors, and then we can compare chance of dying for other things, accidents, but then we've got the breast cancer, down here the lung disease, stroke, and heart attack. Now, how can we compare these in other ways? We can order them, or we can scatter them around, look at these different causes of death. Or another thing we quite like is the idea of using word clouds, where the size of the font represents the chance of the event occurring. So it's not so good to measure things, but you get an immediate impression of the power of the lung disease and the bigger risk of the heart attack from the smokers. People have actually tried looking at these things, word clouds, in other contexts. We've been trying it for weather forecasts, and the British Met Office has been experimenting with word clouds to communicate weather forecasts. Now, who would like to see there, if this was the probability, the chances of it raining a particular time and place, whatever. Can I just ask, a quick little survey, who likes this idea of to represent uncertainty? Yeah, cool. Who doesn't like it? Really good. Yeah, exactly. Now, exactly. Thank you very much for proving my point. The Met Office said this is like Marmite. People either really like it or they really hate it. They can't stand it. And the point about it is that the psychological research on risk communication has shown that there's enormous variability in people's preferences and likes and dislikes. There's no one size fits all. So the crucial thing is what we're exploring is the idea that using animations and interactive graphics, allowing people to choose the representation they like best. It's very important that. And this is another, this is really looks like a sort of old Otto Norak graph. This is, for people like me taking statins, the chance of what might happen in the next 5 years. 1,000 men like me, the benefits of taking statins is that there would be this many fewer heart attacks and strokes, and actually one fewer esophageal cancer. This is using the latest data from the British Medical Journal. But at the cost of a couple of acute renal failures, 15 cataracts, 6 liver dysfunctions, and 10 myopathies. Now, of course, these are not necessarily, could easily outweigh these. They're not worth the same necessarily, because this could be a lot more important. But it gives an idea of the risk balance. There's also a big missing gap here, which I could also illustrate. The fact that 1,000 people have to take tablets every day for 10 years, for year, day after day. They're medicalised, they're turned into patients. Now, that's not necessarily a disadvantage. It might lead to them getting better care. But this is sort of invisible, generally not counted, possible harm of a medical treatment, of just being turned into a patient. So we're exploring different ways to illustrate these things, using images, using frequencies, getting away from the words of probability. Now, I love looking at risk stories in the news. I don't know if anyone saw this one earlier this week. Girl cannot walk to bus stop alone. A father is being threatened by a council with child protection issues for allowing a 7-year-old daughter to walk 20 metres from their home to the bus stop unaccompanied. Now, in a few of the talks at this meeting, we've heard about people feeling the pressure of unnecessary regulation, of bureaucracy, of over-concern for... and overprotection of children in particular. And so one of the things I'm going to talk about today is deconstructing risk stories in the news. So how can we take this story apart? What are the risks to 7-year-old children anyway and in walking to school perhaps? So it turns out that 7-year-old children are unbelievably safe. They're the safest age of the safest generation that's ever existed in this country. A 7-year-old girl, 1 in 12,000 of 7-year-old girls will die before they're 8. It's a terrible tragedy, of course, but unbelievably rare. One of the ways that's useful is to look at the risks people face is to be able to make comparisons. And a strange unit of comparison that you may have heard of, but I find very useful, is a micromort. A micromort is a 1 in a million chance of dying. It's what that little man over there faced every time there was a lightning strike. The one in a million chance. It's like flipping a coin 20 times in a row, coming up heads every time. Now, it's quite a good unit because every day in England and Wales, 50 people die of non-natural causes. They're essentially killed. You know, they don't die of their disease or anything like that. They in a car crash, or they fall down a ladder, or whatever, or some sort of accident, or they're murdered. You know, very few, but that can happen. So, and that's about 50 out of 50 million people. So our sort of average risk, very much an average, some people a lot more, some people a lot less, is 1 micromort a day. So how can we spend our micromort? Well, of course, we can go travelling. How far can we get, you know, on our micromort if we drive? Well, it turns out you can get about 200 miles, maybe slightly more than that, to spend your micromort. There'll be more on motorways, be less probably on rural roads like around here. For children, it's actually more. It's about 1,000 miles for children because this includes, sadly, all the young male drivers who have accidents. So actually for kids, it's actually quite a lot more when you're considering about whether to drive them to school, allowing them to walk to school. So then other ways of travelling, cycling, again, this is with an average by bike, you get about 20 miles, about 10 times the risk. Of course, it may give you all sorts of other benefits, but in terms of actual distance, it's not so safe, of course. And walking, again, 17 miles. A motorbike, any bikers here, any bikers? Yeah, you don't get very far for your money, in fact. You only get about 6 miles. You get about 6 miles on a micromort. And so six miles on a motorbike is quite a good unit to think of other things. Like, every time you have a general anaesthetic, it's about 10 micromorts, about 60 miles on a motorbike. Giving birth, 80. It's about 500 miles on a motorbike. Interesting ones we've been doing, serving in Afghanistan at the moment. For the last few months, serving in Afghanistan, it's been a cost of 46 micromorts a day on average. For people serving in Afghanistan, and that's averaged over all UK personnel serving in Afghanistan. So 46 times 6, that's a 300-mile motorbike ride every day is the equivalent risk for serving in Afghanistan. So you can get some really vivid comparisons. Using heroin, 30 a day, using heroin, micromorts, 200 miles on a motorbike. So you can get some really powerful comparisons by doing this. And what about girls walking to school? Well, it turns out in 2008, look at the ONS figures, the statistics, there's 1.5 million girls between ages of 5 and 9. And 137 of them died, and 7 of them died in road accidents, and 1 died as a pedestrian. So 1 out of 1.5 million 5 to 9-year-old girls was killed on the roads as a pedestrian in 2008. Now, that was quite a low figure, a low year, and it was boys have doubled the risk of girls on average, and boys take more risks on the road. But that still is a very small figure. That was actually less than a micromort. Now, the official rule of the guidance of the Health and Safety Executive, who probably is not the most popular body in this room, but they are very explicit that the rule for considering a risk as being essentially acceptable, and the border between acceptable and even tolerable is a micromort a year, 1 in a million chance of death per year. So if a cause of death has got less than a micromort a year, the Health and Safety Executive consider that as acceptable. It's not actually worth doing anything about. So it makes one wonder whether harm that a child suffers, every accident is a terrible tragedy, everything should be done as possible to avoid it. But there comes a point when you've got to say perhaps things can be safe enough, and we need to encourage children to be out and doing as much as possible. So the other aspect that's quite tricky is how much are you willing to pay to a micromort? Okay, yeah, let's do a little study. I'm going to flip a coin 20 times, and if it comes up heads every time, I'm allowed to choose which way I put you to death. Now, who will do that for? I'll give you £1,000. Anyone do it for £1,000? Yes, of course you would. All right. Anyone do it for £1? Yeah, one. Hey, it's a risk taker. Someone does it for £1. Yeah, it's good. In fact, I did this with the schools. I don't know, with the science festival. A little boy put his hand up. Yeah, I'll do it for £1. So I start flipping the coin, and 8 heads later, his mum is looking a bit worried, and then I show him I've got a 2-headed coin that I always use in these situations. So which just also illustrates the point that trust is an integral part of all this. Yeah. Okay, so history's not always a reliable guide, though. We've been talking about areas where there is data we can do history. For example, let's say we're trying to predict the odds of Barack Obama being the next president of the United States. And these are the odds given by Betfair, a betting exchange, for the whole year, every day, before Barack Obama was elected. And it wobbles up and down in receipt of new evidence, new data, new feelings about what the risk is. And so we're led to that point that, actually, what does probability mean in that context? And I'd say, in general, that probability is actually, it doesn't exist. And there's good, probability does not exist. There's a famous textbook in theory of probability that starts with those words. Probability does not exist. This first slightly radical thing I'm going to say. So I believe that probability, that whole number, everything you put on that, is a construct. It's based on our judgment, it's based on our current knowledge about what's going on, and it's purely in terms of what betting odds we think might be reasonable. The actual probability is not a property of the world. And that's quite useful because it makes you realise that our whole response to risk is also constructed. And actually thinks maybe this sort of mathematical analysis that I've done all my life and I'm very fond of, you know, is not, of course, the only approach to risk. We have to acknowledge that the approach to risk to our feelings is absolutely vital. We've lived with this for ages. The mathematics of risk is only a few hundred years old. And we can't say everyone before that was not stupid. They dealt with risk and uncertainty in probably with a lot of wisdom. And so our feelings, our gut feelings, work very well in response to risk most of the time. However, not always. And so what I'd like to say is that sometimes we have to use analysis. Sometimes we have to think a bit deeper about these things. And because sometimes people are trying to con us. Here was a headline in the Daily Telegraph last year. 9 in 10 people carry a gene which increases the risk of high blood pressure. Oh my God, we're all going to die. No. The story was that 1 in 10 people carry a gene which decreases the risk of high blood pressure. Clever bit of PR. Wasn't the journalist, it was the media people in the institution that managed to get this story, such national coverage. So we can, we're affected so much by what we hear. You know, one of the things complaints about, I've been thinking about this meeting, which has been wonderful, is that we're only hearing about the successes. Where are the failures? It's like only seeing film of people hitting holes in one and they're playing golf. What about all the ones that didn't fail? Ed, with his wonderful walk up in the Amazon. What about the ghosts that didn't make it? The bleached bones in Peru. Why don't we see photographs of those? Now, you know, it's a bit mean. We're supposed to be inspired by success and examples. It's great. But actually, no, let's face it. We've got to look at the fact that things fail. Things don't work. We need to consider all the consequences of our actions and think about those. And what if we're uncertain about the risks? What if we just don't understand what's going on? And this is where we have to think about another type of uncertainty. I've been talking about chance, essentially, unpredictability, randomness. But we've got another type of uncertainty, and I won't use the two-headed coin this time. If I flip a coin, before I flip it, the chance it comes up heads, people would say, I think, would 50-50. Then I flip it, cover it up. What's the probability this is heads? It's still 50-50. It is the probability it's heads. You don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. Ah, what's your probability this is heads? 50-50. No, my probability isn't. Yeah, you lost. It's tails. So the point about that, we've changed into a different type of uncertainty. We've gone from chance and randomness to what's called epistemic uncertainty, which is lack of knowledge. It's our ignorance. And so that's the last thing I want to point out, is the fact that an integral part of risk and thinking about risk is to acknowledge that we don't know, acknowledge our ignorance. And there's a silly story that I think is quite nice. There was a silly story in the Times about someone who bought 6 eggs in a box, and they all had double yolks. And the Times says, 1 in 1 trillion, 1 in 1,000 eggs are double yolks, and 6 eggs, oh, 1 in 1 trillion. It's quite extraordinary. And but then what happened to me, I bought, the next box of eggs I bought, they were all double yolks. There I am, glass of wine, ready for the mother of all omelettes, and, you know, another go for the arteries, and that's what happened. How does that 1 in 1 trillion chance, how did I do it? Well, I went to Waitrose and bought a box of double-yolked eggs. Amazing! So, this whole story was bollocks. You know, complete nonsense. There was no chance in double-yolked eggs at all. So then we actually, you know, lead to appeal to that great sage, Donald Rumsfeld, and realise that there are unknown unknowns. We've got to acknowledge there are things that we just don't know about, and that these could be so important. So my very final slide, sorry to go on, this is Oliver Cromwell, dead. Now, because I want to talk about Cromwell's law, it's my final slide. Cromwell He was about to give battle to the Church of Scotland, and he was trying to get the Church of Scotland to actually back down. And so he wrote to them, nice little letter, and he said, "Is it therefore infallibly agreeable to the word of God, all that you say? I beseech you, in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." The plea for humility by the Church of Scotland. Of course, it failed, and they didn't admit they were mistaken, and he had to beat them in battle. But that phrase is very useful, because it's a plea for humility, for acknowledgement that we may be wrong, the possibility of error. Now, it doesn't mean you can't act, doesn't mean it shouldn't be paralysis, but the possibility of wrong, of being wrong, seems to be an absolutely integral part, again, about thinking about risks. And with that, I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.